by my mid-40s, I realized I've got to make a difference. And then I was in Barcelona, Spain at a pharmaceutical convention. I had this epiphany, literally looking out across 3,000-4,000 people that, oh my God, I'm unhappy. Wow, I should be elated. I'm in Barcelona, Spain on a full expense account, staying at the JW Marriott, wearing a beautiful suit, you know, at this conference. And I am freaking miserable. Like, I got to change something. And within 4 to 5 months of that, I had left and started this company.
This is Bridging the Gap with your host, Matt Reiner.
Roger Martin, welcome to Bridging the Gap. How are you, my friend?
I am doing great. Thank you for having me. I appreciate this.
This is great. It's not often that I have on the podcast an ASU alum from the East Coast. I don't know if actually you've ever had an ASU alumni, an Arizona State University alumni. It's few and far between, given how many people go to that school. But it's always good to reconnect and have that connection in that way. So I'm super stoked about this conversation. I think as we were talking about pre-show, you've got a background that has exposure to so many aspects of building a business and growing a business and selling within a business that I think is so beneficial to our listeners. And I want to dive into that in your journey. And we will get to that. There's so much there. I hope we have enough time. We probably need like 5 hours to get to everything, but we'll get to as much of it as we can. But before we dive into that, I'm curious, you know, what did the 13-year-old Roger Martin want to be when he grew up?
That's a great question. And I probably will answer it differently than listeners who know my background, 25 years in the pharmaceutical business and corporate America, and then starting to other national brands. I wanted to be a rock star. I didn't have Michael Jordan posters on my wall. I didn't have, you know, a Walter Payton poster. I had Eddie Van Halen and other Steve Vai and these other guitar legends. Growing up, I started music when I was pretty young. I've always loved music and was playing live in you know, like live garage bands at parties and stuff in high school, and then later all through college and even in my 20s. So even into my 20s, as I was building a pharmaceutical career, I was still thinking like, okay, what point do I cut bait and go to Hollywood? So it is a different, usually, you know, the people that have had a lot of success in business didn't start wanting to be on a stage with a guitar, with fog and lights and all that. But if I'm really honest, that was my goal, that you know, from a very, very early age, which is ironic because my son is 20 years old and he's in Los Angeles pursuing a music career. So I guess the apple didn't fall too far from the tree there.
That's incredible. And now, I mean, you go from desiring to be a rock star to being an author, a founder, you're president of a pharmaceutical company. Like, your journey has, you know, really progressed in a direction different from what you wanted to be when you were 13 years old. Tell us about that journey. Walk us through kind of the progression going from the rock star dreams to leading a pharmaceutical company, and then ultimately starting, you know, the entrepreneurial journey and having a fitness franchise and a light sauna franchise, right? I mean, yeah. Talk to us through that journey.
Yeah. So my life, I almost look at is in three parts. You know, one is the learning. I mean, we're always learning. I'm still learning today. But you know, the real focused learning, formal schooling, undergrad. I later got my MBA when I was actually working. But, you know, I look at that, like my first session of my life was all about learning. And then I built a career in the pharmaceutical business. So I graduated from Arizona State University, so ASU as an undergrad, which is funny because on the East Coast, you say ASU, everybody thinks Appalachian State, you know, completely different. But I got into pharma because one, it was a great paying job, but I also loved the science behind it. I loved having really advanced conversations and in-depth conversations with physicians who are, you know, very professional and usually very professional and very intelligent and educated. And that was a challenge to me. So then I look at the second part of my life the second chapter was building that career in pharma. And I worked for, I want to say, four different companies that were branded pharmaceutical companies. And then I went to work for a private equity firm to run a couple of manufacturing plants that they had and do biz dev for them and whatnot. But during that 25 years, I moved my family 8 times in 14 of those 25 years. I lived in all four corners of the United States and the middle in Dallas, Texas as well. So I really look at that as when I honed my chops, when I learned my leadership skills, you know, made a lot of mistakes with other people's money, quite frankly, as you learn. And I think that's the benefit of working for a larger corporation when you're younger. You can get all that training, all that learning, all that education, while you're giving them a great return on their investment, but also they're investing in you. And then I look at the third part, we can talk about that. I'm most excited about the third part of my life that I'm in right now, which was a transition from corporate America into entrepreneurship. And literally on a Friday after I had named a successor and had a succession plan and about a 3-month offboarding process to really ensure that the company I was leaving, was in good hands. And then I made myself available for them afterwards, of course. But on a Friday, my salary ended, my healthcare ended, my, you know, Cadillac benefits and stock options and all that, I walked away from to start a national fitness franchise and you start with one location. That's how it starts. And that was a very humbling experience. On a Friday, I wore a suit and tie, and on a Monday, I'm there in swishy pants and a t-shirt hoisting steel up into the rafters to hang boxing bags and whatnot. So crazy story. I kind of outlined it in a book I recently published, but I really look at my life, Matt, in three, like that learning phase, that younger youth phase that went into my 20s, then building my career in corporate America and really learning my finance chops, certainly my persuasion influence chops were really honed there. And then, leading teams, building teams, hiring. I believe in, you have to spend the time, the money, the effort in how you hire and build a team, because you go nowhere with the wrong team. And then I'm so grateful that I have the ability now to apply all of that learning into building my own businesses. And I've thoroughly enjoyed the last 7-8 years of doing that.
I love that breakdown of kind of a career or life in general. It's like, you got the learning, you got the honing, and you got the application phase, right? And I think, sometimes too many people try to move too quickly across that. And I think, you think about like a lot of the books on mastery and everything of that nature, going from learning to application, you miss out on the honing, which is when you get the mentoring and there's a lot of extra learning that you miss, and you can't, and too many people think that just because they have an MBA, they can apply all that to the real world. And that's just not the case. Mm. Yeah. I'm curious, because you went from kind of corporate America to now instead of applying it inside of corporate America in a deeper, differentiated way, you're now applying it in a whole different realm of a vertical, but it's also entrepreneurship. Did you always know you had an entrepreneurship bug? What inspired that bug? Or was this like just the route you said, this is the best way for me to apply everything I've learned in the most tangible way, in my opinion?
Yeah, that's a really insightful question. No, I'm not the kid that, I love to make money. Even as a young boy, loved to, work, hustle, whatever I had to do to make some extra money and have my own money. Like, I've always loved that feeling. And I think there's a feeling of independence with all the listeners that are listening to this know that feeling. There's no better feeling than making your own way. But, I didn't have 14 paper routes when I was 10, and I didn't have, the 16 lemonade stands with all the kids working for me. Like, I wish I maybe had known how to do that earlier in life, but I didn't. I was a little more risk averse started making a pretty good income at a fairly young age, which is a blessing and it's a curse. When you have nothing to lose, there's nothing to lose. And so you go for it. And I think because I got into a pretty lucrative industry at a young age and was making a nice solid living, I don't think you'll get extremely wealthy in corporate America, and you can't accrue the wealth you can on your own. But I was very, very comfortable. My family was comfortable. I had my kids' college fund paid for, by the time they were, by the time I was in my mid-30s, and I'm 53 now, and they both just finished. But no, man, the real answer is I was a little risk averse, or a lot risk averse, and would dabble. So before the term side hustle was actually a term, I had attempted a couple different things, but it was always one toe barely in. If I'm really honest, it wasn't one foot in. It was like one toe. And if the water got cold, that's okay, because I got a great salary and stock options and all this other stuff over here. So that's okay. I will tell any of your listeners that if they're looking to make that, and that's, by the way, that is absolutely fine. There's nothing wrong or right with that. Because I think, in today's culture, where's your jet and where's your Lambo? And it's all BS. But having a great job, providing for your family, not having some of the stress of entrepreneurship, that is absolutely fine. But what I found is I got to the point where that didn't satisfy me, and I didn't want it to be the way I left this world. And I still had runway in front of me. I certainly have less runway in front of me than I have behind me at this age, but I just had gotten to my mid 40s and realized, okay, I don't think I want to keep building someone else's house. I don't want to keep doing all of the hard work and making other people, I made a lot of money, but made other people a whole lot more money when I could do this for myself. And I got to a certain point, and let's be very candid that, you know, I think when you have a few bucks in the bank, when you are confident in your skills, when your family has somewhat been taken care of because you've lived beneath your means and set that aside, I almost manufactured the opportunity and probably did that for about a decade to allow myself to take the risk. I certainly wasn't cognizant of it when I was doing it back in my 30s. I was raised to live beneath your means and to save and be ready for, you know, whatever could come. But I think subconsciously, if I really explored that, it had to have been setting myself up to finally make this without as much consternation. And, you know, if I did swing and miss, that would have really sucked, but I would have been okay. That would have been okay. And so in life, it's crazy. And we talked about these three phases. I would, like my own children, I would tell them, go to work for a company in your early 20s. You know, of course, my son's taken a whole different path, but my daughter works for a big CPG company, you know, went to school at Chapel Hill, went off to this big company, and she's getting great training. And I would tell her, if she wants to be an entrepreneur, by the time you're 26, 28, then go for it, because you still don't have a lot to lose, probably don't have a family yet. And that's the time to go for it, because you get into your 30s and life kind of gets more serious. You have a mortgage, you've got probably a couple car payments, you know, you start to save for your kids, or you have kids, which aren't cheap. So people that do it in their 30s, I have a lot of respect for, because I found in my 40s, it became easier because I was getting my kids to the point that they would be okay. You know, we were okay financially and would be okay. And I had this skill set that I had acquired for the previous 25 years that I knew had value in the marketplace. So, I mean, I've never been asked that or answered the question this way, but I would say go for it in your late 20s or early 20s, if that's what you choose. But I think there's a benefit to learning on someone else's dime for a few years. And then if you don't, your listeners, I would say, will probably find that in their mid-40s, it actually becomes easier, as crazy as that sounds, unless you're living like a bonehead and spending every dime you have, and, you know, and you're not, I don't think this is your audience, but, you know, you're not saving, you're not investing, you're not trying to accrue wealth, you know, on your own in a corporate environment. So long-winded answer to your question, but that's kind of how I look at it.
I love that answer. I mean, I think that perspective, and, you know, what I was thinking as I was listening to that answer was, you mentioned how you weren't a young entrepreneur. You didn't have that bug. A lot of entrepreneurs I talked to, like, they were like, yeah, I was always like starting this and starting that. Yeah. And that wasn't you. And you were vulnerable and said, I was risk averse. I was always dipping a toe in. It's always easy to do something when you have a fallback plan, right? Yep. And it's you usually kind of, you always are more willing to try a lot of things, and actually loses focus. I learned that with one of my startups as well. But I'm curious how you overcame that risk aversion, because ultimately you took that leap of faith, and you can't be a risk averse entrepreneur. Like, it's risky. No. And so I'm interested in, like, what that transition was. What were some of those struggles? Because I'm sure there's many advisors that may want to do it on their own as well, but they're fearful of what it means to be on your own.
Yep. For the advisors listening, there is no one answer or simple, or I don't have a slick one-liner to say, you know, here. I just know that I got to the point in my life where the pain of staying was worse than the risk of trying. And I had shoulder surgery, I don't know, 7-8 years ago or so. And you know, I kept getting shots and drugs and different things. And finally I was like, I think I need to have surgery. I think it's time to have surgery and this was like to the physician assistant. And I said, how do you know when it's time though? Like, how? And she goes, you just know, like, you know, like, no more shots, no more pills, no more, you know, like, no more physical therapy. Like, you got to fix it. And I think in my life, in my early 40s, I was becoming unsettled and uncomfortable and disenfranchised. And by my mid 40s, I realized I've got to make a difference. And then I'll spare you the whole story, but, and I've told this 1,000 times, I was in Barcelona, Spain at a pharmaceutical convention, and I had this epiphany, literally looking out across 3,000-4,000 people, that, oh my God, I'm unhappy. Wow, I should be elated. I'm in Barcelona, Spain on a full expense account, staying at the JW Marriott, wearing a beautiful suit, you know, at this conference. And I am freaking miserable. Like, I got to change something. And within 4 to 5 months of that, I had left and started this company, one of the companies, yeah.
That's incredible. I think that everybody can relate to that idea of like, you just know, sometimes you just know when it's time. And if you don't have that feeling, then it's just not time yet. You can't force entrepreneurship, right?
Yep.
You got to know that it's the time. Like I started my first one before I had kids. Like if I thought about starting another one right now, like it'd be tough. My kids are young. It's hard. But and you should never say never, because your life continues to evolve and you change. And so I love that answer. Yeah, I want to transition from, you know, some of the lessons learned, or transition to some of the lessons learned. I want to try to make this a progression. I want to start the foundation aspect. And that's really of like this idea of building a brand. And, you know, I'm curious, because you worked at big brands with big brand names, and that marketing selling strategy is different than you now starting an entrepreneur and having to build a brand on your own with starting with a blank slate. And I think about kind of the brands inside of Wealth Manager, there's so much opportunity to build brands. But what have you seen as being like the different tactics one needs to use when building a brand, when building the brand relative to just marketing an already known brand, right? I think that's everybody thinks they're great marketers when they're marketing for Coca-Cola because Coca-Cola's already got the brand. But when you're just Matt Reiner or Roger Martin, nobody knows who you are, and it's a different, you can't use the same tactics that you used at Coke to build your own brand. So I'm curious what you experienced in that, you know, from that perspective.
Yeah. I just have to comment on what you said about Coca-Cola. So one of my clients of the firm that I was a president of, when I worked for a private equity firm who owned a couple of different portfolio companies in pharma, was Gunthy Ranker. And Gunthy Ranker is one of the largest, I don't know if infomercials are still a big thing, but they were huge back in the 90s and 2000s. And Proactiv, which is an acne medication, Rodan-Enfield's Proactiv, one of the biggest, it was like an $800 million product line, which is pretty crazy for an infomercial. And when I call on, there wasn't a person I met in the industry that I worked in, because it was topical products, that had worked at Gunthy Ranker that didn't tell me that they were responsible for the success of Proactiv. Like, they're not a single person, didn't matter if they were still at Gunthy Ranker or they had gone on to these other companies, I happened to meet them or we were helping them. Like, every single person took credit for that out of the park smash, you know, walk off homer. And I just found it funny. Like,
that's like PayPal. Everybody says they're co-founder of PayPal. It's like, you run into it, it's like the PayPal mafia. I'm like, how big is this mafia? It's like every single person, the intern even says they were a co-founder
exactly.
of PayPal.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. So it is, I mean, Matt, your question is great, because it is so different when you're working on an established brand, or even when you are starting a new brand name or a line extension, or, you know, for wealth management, maybe it's a new line of services and you need to brand that, but it's within a bigger umbrella. You know, you're sitting under a giant umbrella of brand recognition. That is way different than, okay, I'm going to create something out of thin air. And the thing that I can share with you unabashedly, and the listeners really should take away from this, is there is, other than having children, there is probably no better feeling than birthing a brand, building that brand, and then driving somewhere that's, you know, 500 miles or flying across the country and seeing that brand that you created at your kitchen table, or, you know, in a small rented office, on a sign, you know, in a mall next to a Whole Foods or something, or a strip mall. You know, that is one of the most amazing feelings you can have. And it's, even if it's more of a virtual brand, if like some of the advisors may not even need brick and mortar, I don't know, but they, knowing that somebody else is talking about your company that you've built from scratch when you're not around and you had nothing to do with the manifestation of that conversation, is one of the craziest, amazing feelings that you can have, because you created something out of nothing and added to the world in a way that will forever change it. And I don't mean to be melodramatic there, but it really was that impactful to me. It has been that impactful to me. So the difference, I would say, though, is one, you can't make a lot of mistakes because it's your money you're playing with. And two, and I share this with all newer entrepreneurs that I help mentor or are just looking for advice, is when you're going to build a brand, spend the money up front. So many people hear about minimum viable product, and I get it, totally get that. But not around the brand. That's around the product. That's around, does this service, you know, if I package these services, or does this offering even make sense? Yeah, test it, man. Get it together, get it ready, and test it. But if you're actually going to, if you do the market test and you see there's a market fit, okay, slow down, put some money in the middle, and you know, go hire a great marketing consultant, that first thing we did was hire two great marketing consultants, one on the West Coast that I had as a reference and the other on the East Coast that I'd worked with many times before. So the first money we spent, when I say we, I had a co-founder with Rockbox, was on marketing, branding, renaming, renamed the company from we had, the guy I got together with had one studio previously. You know, everything about it was from the ground up, but I could not have gotten there even close without the two branding consultants that we had. And they didn't see eye to eye, which was great because it gave us the best of both worlds and the best thinking. And I'm still proud of Rockbox Fitness, super proud of Beam Light Sauna that's just taken off like a rocket, because we get so many compliments on the brand and how it looks. And that was intentional. That was like, we were not going to take it out of the barn, so to speak, until it was ready for prime time. And as an entrepreneur, we're told, you know, minimum viable product, just get to market. And I believe in that, to test your theory. But that's not how you test your brand. Because if you don't spend the money now and up front, you will spend so much more on the back end to fix it, to rebrand it. And you want to be able to calculate the opportunity cost that you've lost with a poor looking brand that doesn't have all the components. And it's not just, and everything's brand, you know, logo and colors and look and feel. That's just the logo. That's the iconography. The brand personality, what you stand for, your brand values. And I know we've all been in companies, I was in several of them, that you had brand values on the wall, or they were in, you know, a folder in your employee welcome folder that was in the bottom drawer of your desk that you never looked at because they really didn't live their values. But if you build a brand around a set of values and then you live those values in your company, you hire fire by those values, they become part of your brand personality. And you have to be very intentional about your brand personality and who you want to attract, and just as importantly, who you want to repel. And you know, if somebody doesn't have a lot of experience at marketing and building a brand, they should not think that they can watch a YouTube video and this is, you know, they may absolutely kill it, but very rare. Like, get some professional help in. They should make all the decisions. It should be from your heart and soul, what you believe in, what resonates with you, because it's your brand. But man, get some great help up front. Spend the money up front and it'll save you 20x on the back end. Plus, you don't have to go back and slow down later to fix it.
I love that idea of the MVP you can experiment with, but you don't experiment with the brand. And mm-hmm. I think that that's super important. You can always test a product or a theory under a different name and under a thesis and a hypothesis and get data. And I think that that's super important. Yep. Before spending money on a brand. Too many people go and spend the money on the brand before they test the hypothesis. And they're like, well, we got a good brand, but a terrible product.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work. And so I think that there's, you know, you have to do the testing, which is great. But then once you figure out that there is something there, then like you said, pause. And I love the idea of bringing in and spending the money up front, because what I learned in the process and what I've taken away from what you said is you really only get one shot with the brand. If you miss on that, it's more costly to go and win that prospective client back than it was to then invest to get them to see you for the first time, because you've already cracked trust. Like, trust, the four C's is, you know, confidence and consistency and competence and all that stuff. And so if you don't have that up front, then it's going to be hard because you've now got cracks in the surface and it's hard to repave that. And so you've got to spend the money up front. I think that that's super important on the brand. Now, I think that one of the challenges that people have with brands is the connection to people, right? Having your brand truly connect with others. And I think that through stories and messaging, you can do that. But some people aren't really great at it. And so I'm curious from your perspective and what you've learned through that experience, both with your past history with corporate America and now entrepreneurial. What is the key in making a message connect with someone versus the message falling just flat?
Yeah, you've got some great questions there, Matt. I would say that story, again, has to be intentional. Now, it's funny because you can play that hand two ways. With Rockbox Fitness, our first franchise and national brand, you couldn't find myself or Steve, who was my original partner in this. You couldn't find us on the website. You couldn't find, like, we purposefully put all of the focus on the, now, of course, we have franchisees, right? That's our customer, but they have members and their customer who actually use the services. All of the focus was on the member. All of the stories, all of the success stories, the heritage was all about members and their success and how this would change their life in a positive way, and how the studio, this fitness studio, could change the local community that it served. Because it's funny, you know, I wanted to stand on the stage, be the rock star. But when I started this brand, I felt it the right move was not, well, here's my story and I'm a corporate refugee and blah, blah, blah. Who cares? Like, that has nothing to do with Rockbox and this brand. That's just an ego driven thing that, you know, I want my face on it. So we were purposely absent from all of the storyboarding and all of the media we did, all of it. Now, the other way to play that hand, and we're doing that with a different brand called Beam Light Sauna, which is an infrared sauna studio. So just think of the same thing where you go to a 2,000 square foot brick and mortar and you know, you have a membership, and then you can go use the infrared private in your own suite infrared saunas, or separately red light therapy. So it's all light therapy. But that brand is being built around one of my co-founders and her story, which is amazing. A young teenage mother at 16, 17, and has turned, you know, what could change the direction of someone's life into the most beautiful, amazing life with a wonderful family, and now you know, a couple of businesses that she runs, and it's a wonderful, empowering story. And we're building the brand around that because it makes sense and it resonates, and it will resonate with the core customer of that studio. A corporate refugee starting a boxing for fitness franchise, members don't really care. They're just like, hey, dude, can you get these 30 pounds off me before summer comes? And I'm going to, you know, to the Cape, and I want to have my shirt off. Like, don't care about you. I care about me. Where with Cynthia, my partner in this other business, it makes total sense to build it around her. And so any of the listeners, again, be intentional. Maybe not even have an idea before you meet with your team and your consultants and you do the market research. Because you can play that hand either way and be successful either way. But if you misplay that hand, you could really handicap what you're trying to get across to your core consumer.
That idea of the difference about how you build the brands is really interesting, because what I've always been challenged with and been intrigued by and curious on is these companies that build brands around the company. I've seen, and I'm curious, I want your perspective, it seems that it's harder to do than to build it around a person, because connection comes to it, other humans, not to products. And I always think about, like, you know, Apple, I think about Microsoft, I think about, you know, Coca-Cola even. You know, the way that we know the brand today, that's not how it started to be built, right? It started by around the people, and then it became the company. And so with you are now living in that world of like two different ways of doing it. I'm curious what you've seen be the pros and cons maybe of each side of it, because I think that so many, you know, especially when it comes to like relationship business and wealth management, I've always said it's like the brand needs to be you and your story. People are going to connect to you. They don't necessarily connect to Morgan Stanley anymore or Merrill Lynch. They connect to, you know, Roger Martin at blank firm. So what have you learned or experienced of like the differences of building the brand around a person or the company that you have to be consistent of or cautious of on that side? Mm.
Again, kind of that double-sided thing there, where certainly it is easier to build a brand around a personality, and every human being has a personality of different sorts, but there's also risk in that. So yes, it is, it's easier, but then two things I would say that are just, you know, kind of blatantly obvious is, one, if that particular person does something irresponsible, well, that's a direct reflection on the brand. But two, if you ever want to sell your business, which someday I want to sell our businesses, if it's built around a person, it's hard for that person to exit, because the brand is that person. And so if you're bought, you know, by private equity, or if you're, you know, even a private transaction, going public would be a little different, but the brand is you. When you mentioned Apple, certainly we experience Apple in a different way. We still think about Steve Jobs. You can't think about Apple, not think about Steve Jobs. But if Apple's products were terrible, we wouldn't be talking about Apple right now. Like, the products were the hero. Steve Jobs was kind of the figurehead, and the brand was, but the Macintosh computer, I remember being, you know, I was 14, I think, when that thing came out. And I remember seeing, like, oh my God, this little box on a desk, you know, I can publish stuff with. At 14, I can make a newsletter. And that was the hero of that brand. So yes, it is easier, and you think it's probably quicker to build a brand around a personality, and especially like with the influencer world and whatnot. But again, there's so much inherent risk in that. And how do you sell that business? if it is the person. And so I would submit to your listeners, I know a lot of wealth advisors, that if they're thinking about creating their own brand around themselves, and again, trust is so huge in your industry, so I understand that, maybe it's more of a standalone brand and identity that's based on the personal characteristics that have made you so trustworthy, that have made you so appreciated by your clients, so liked by your clients. Like, those same attributes can be infused into an inanimate brand. But, and you can even have iconography, you can have even a mascot, as crazy as that sounds. You know, wealth management would be something more responsible, maybe even conservative looking, but you then ascribe all those personality behavior traits to that thing, that inanimate object that doesn't ask for a raise, by the way, that doesn't, you know, leave. And then when you sell the business, you'll get a bigger multiple off that, because that all that goodwill goes with the buyer versus, well, I hope he or she sticks around and doesn't bolt, you know, after we buy 80% of this thing. And so if one of your listeners is thinking, you know, or many are thinking about doing it, like, go for it and use it. If you're a trustworthy person who's built a great book of business, lean into that. But lean into, why did you build a good book business? Like, why will they give you their money and trust their future to you? But there's probably specific reasons. Well, there's the basis of your brand. I just wouldn't put my picture on it and say, I am the brand, because again, worst case scenario, let's say you get really hurt and you're not even able to service the business. Well, the business is done. But if you've built it independent of you and you have a team, that thing can go on for centuries.
That's such a good perspective. I mean, it's so much of an idea of it's flattering to have the brand be about you, but it's also a bottleneck as well, because then, you know, I realize that as well. When you are the brand, it becomes a bottleneck to the, you haven't really necessarily built a business necessarily. It's hard because you need a business is able to run with or without you. And, you know, maybe you start out where it's around you, but you've got, if you do that, what I take away from what you said is you've got to figure out a way to transition that brand over time to being about the company. It can maybe start with you, but eventually the success of the business is based on the execution you have of transitioning that brand away from you and to be more about the business, or multiple people in the business to create some, you know, diversification, just like you would do in a portfolio. You need that there.
Yeah.
You know, I want to shift gears to a second, right? So, because we talked about brand, and we talked about starting and building a brand, which I think is key. But then the next point is about sales, right? You can build a brand, you can build a great product, but you got to sell, right? Yep. You've got to get revenue in the door. And you were on a podcast, I think it was called Better Presentations, More Sales. And you talked about this, how to present your sales presentation to a client as though they were a six-year-old or maybe a fifth grader. I don't know if six-year-olds are in fifth grade. I don't think they are yet, but I like six-year-old even better. And I know that that was like delivering a sales presentation, but I think that there's a lot of tangible aspects of that that we can learn in terms of a sales conversation that we have with clients. And, you know, I'm curious to your perspective, like, what are the keys to breaking down concepts that we are so close to, that we understand so deeply, but yet who we're talking to doesn't understand it on our level because they don't think about it as much as we do. And we need to be able to break it down really simplistically, but also get our point across in a very elegant way. And so I'm curious, like, what have you learned from the keys to do that so well?
Yeah. Yeah. That's funny, because we just had an all call, which is a network-wide call. So a nationwide call with all of our franchisees for one of our brands today. And I'm leading that call, and I kind of kick it off every time. And then my people, marketing, sales and ops, finance, will give a little basic presentation on whatever's happening in the business that month that for their department that affects the nation. And halfway through one of my VP of Ops presentation, I texted because this is a live call we're doing, live Zoom. I texted the next three presenters and I'm like, please tell them how your slide is going to benefit their business before you even tell them what it's about. Then tell them what it's about, whatever the initiative is. And then please double back at the end and tell them again how it's going to benefit their business. Because again, just today, we are so close to it. And, you know, months have gone into let's say it's a promotion or whatever. And so people that will present that, they will speak to it as you said, as if the listener already knows about this, as if they've been shoulder to shoulder with you building this promotion that you're going to launch this month for the last 3 months. Nope, this is the first time they've heard about it. This is the only, whatever you're sharing with them is the only knowledge they have about this. And it's so easy to get lost in this. And so one of my favorite sayings around leadership, but it applies 100% to sales, is General Douglas MacArthur said, great generals don't give commands that are understood. They give commands that can't be misunderstood. And that is such a subtle but ginormous difference in a communication skill set. And so when we're presenting whatever it is, wealth management services or widgets, it doesn't matter. We start with, why should the customer even listen to us? And if the customer was a six-year-old, what would we say to that customer that would make, if they were 6 years old, that would make them say, okay, that makes sense. Yeah, I should listen to this and this can have a very material impact on me and benefit for me. So let me hear what you have to say next. And I've studied writing copy and advertising extensively in human behavior. You know, David Ogilvy, I wish I could take credit for this, but David Ogilvy, one of the most famous advertisers ever, said, the goal of the headline is to get people to read the first line of copy. And the goal of that first line of copy is to get them to read the second line of copy, and rinse and repeat. And there's no difference that when you're giving a sales presentation, whatever you say first, and please don't do death by PowerPoints, right? Let's use pictures, not words. Steve Jobs is the best at that. Every presentation he had was only three pictures, always three pictures. And he would just tell a story around that. But tell them what you're going to tell them so clearly that a six-year-old couldn't misunderstand it. Then share with them. And then if they have some technical questions, well, that's good for you. You can really show off your expertise. They may not have technical questions and don't feel compelled to answer technically when they don't ask technical questions. And it's hard because, especially if somebody has studied finance and wealth building and diversification and asset allocation, you want to share that because you're proud of the knowledge, it will help them. But at the end of the day, I get back to a super simple example like fitness. Nobody cares about the workout. They only care about the benefit they're gonna get from it. And truly, people don't really care where the money goes. They care how much money is there at the end. And they, you have to show your technical expertise if somebody asks you a tough question, and certainly you should be prepared to go as deep as they want to on that. But what they want to know is, if I give you my money, how much more do I get back at the end of this thing? And how much risk am I actually taking to get that? That's the six-year-old question. And there'll be, of course, you'll have more sophisticated customers and damn straight, then speak to them and speak in their language. But never speak above them because people will think, well, I'm going to impress them. No, you're going to lose them. You're not going to impress them. You're going to lose them.
And it's a matter of don't assume what they want you to say. And some people think that if I sound smart, then they'll believe me more. And it actually is the alternative, right? If you actually just speak to them on their level, they trust you a lot more than you saying things that they don't understand. And I keep thinking, as you're saying, talk to a six-year-old, like my son's 4 and a half. And I think about how I'd have a conversation with him. It'd have to start with, I'm going to help you get dessert later. Like that's how it has to start.
Boom.
Like, that's how he'll be like, all right, let's go to the next stage. And then I'll be like, well, in order to get dessert, the first step is X. We got to do X. He's like, okay, let's go. And he would be strung along the whole plot until he got dessert. And so as simplistic as that sounds, it sometimes seems too simple. But that's kind of the key to it. The more simple it is, I know that a lot of marketers talk about say it in as few words as possible. And until you can get it to where it's like two or three sentences and someone can be like, yeah, I got it, then you don't really know it yet well enough. You may just be repeating different things. You've got to know it really deeply, not so that you can use all the technical knowledge. It's because how you can use that to connect to something that can be understandable by the other person. Yep. And that's when you truly have wisdom as opposed to just knowledge. Knowledge is just a bunch of information. Wisdom is actually connecting it. Now, you mentioned that you did a lot of work on behaviors and how to change behaviors. And one thing that you talked about is that you learned, I think in the stage of honing your skills was persuasion and sales tactics. You've mentioned this, I think it was in the book about persuasion and manipulation and the difference. I'd love for you to go into the difference between the two, but I want to tag on a second question. Okay. I want to tag on the question of, is it possible to persuade with empathy? Mm. Is there an ability to persuade with empathy? And the reason is I ask that is that I feel that empathy is just kind of listening and letting it go and being really understanding. Persuasion is you're trying to get them somewhere. And so I'm curious, is are they two different or can they be worked together based on kind of the understanding of what persuasion is versus manipulation? Because I sometimes think that people manipulate and think they're empathetic or vice versa.
Yeah. I think the best way to answer that question is defining the difference between persuasion, influence, and manipulation. And the best example or understanding of it that I have is it's the same exact skill set. And so the reason it gets conflated and the reason people have an adverse reaction to sales, persuasion, influence, and those words, people can have a visceral reaction to yeah, you know, I want to persuade them to, you know, oh, it's the same skill set. It's the intent. And so with persuasion influence, you are trying to help someone along their path, along their journey. It's a journey they need to go on. They need to accrue more wealth. They need to be more responsible in the way they diversify. They need to entrust someone to help them get to their end goal, whatever that may be. But they're not there yet. Manipulation is, I am going to get you to do something because I'm going to use the same skill set, but I'm going to get you to do something that is bad for you, but benefits me. And, you know, we've all been sold something that we really didn't want or need. And you know, as soon as you leave with that item or you hang up the phone, you feel like the word that comes to mind is icky. Like, right, it just, there's the just a feeling, it's just icky. And you can't even really put into words, like, why do I feel this way? And what just happened? Where when you're persuaded and influenced in a way, and to tag onto your question, with empathy, okay, I think it's kind of hard to truly effectively persuade and influence without genuine empathy. But when you do it with empathy, people hang up the phone or leave the store or whatever it is, and they don't feel icky. They think, who's the first person I should tell about this? Who's the first person I need to like text and say, oh man, I just got this great deal, or I just found this great advice, or man, I'm the most comfortable I've ever been with my future and you know where I'm going to be financially. That's how they feel, because you were empathetic in listening to them. And you know, empathy is almost an overused term today. What it is you genuinely care about them. Like, you genuinely care about them up to and including the point, you know, Mrs. Jones, I think you've got a perfect allocation right now. I can't improve on that. Right now, you should stand pat. Right? You should stand pat. Versus, I got to sell Mrs. Jones. I got to get her, you know, business. I've got to do... That's not empathetic. And yeah, you'll make some money in the short term, but you won't have raving fans, because you want the Mrs. Jones that you say, I don't know if I can help you. She is going to, I promise you this, like, test my theory on this. She is going to figure out a way that you can help her, that you can help her. She will figure out, well, how can we work together some other way? Or maybe I've got a friend that you should help. Like, it's so funny where people are so used to being pitched and sold. And I mean, you know, social media, we're getting an ad every two, you know, flicks of the thumb. And it's just nuts. So when someone slows down and you know, say, why should I buy from you? I'm not even sure you should. That just stops people in their tracks, because it's the antithesis of what they're expecting. And you have to mean it. Not, you know, don't be a smart aleck. I'm not sure I can. But, you know, until we really understand what you're trying to do, I don't know. So let's just focus on that. Let's not worry about doing a deal, getting a business together. Let's figure out where you would just feel amazing if I or anybody else got you there. Let's start there. That is going to be so well, much more well received than, you know, what are you looking to do? Well, let me show you what I got. And let me, you know, let me tell you about this person I've helped. All that comes later. And honestly, 90% of it you can throw out the window, because you don't need to, because once you are empathetic, genuinely empathetic in your needs analysis and your discovery, whatever in your industry, whatever that I call it a needs analysis or an intake, whatever that process is, if you're genuinely empathetic, they will be asking you before you can even tell them, how do we work together? What's the next step? And if we just run the tape back just a second to where, you know, you talked about a sixth grader and or 6 year old and your son being 4.5, I'm very proud. I didn't use any AI or ChatGPT when I wrote this book, An Insider's Guide to Business. It's me pecking out 46,000 words on a laptop. The only technology I use is I ran it through an app that would grade the reading level. And unsurprisingly, you know, I wrote at a collegiate level, but that's not a great book. That's actually a more difficult book to read and to retain. And so writing it actually came fairly easier than I thought it was going to be. but I did 7 full edits, cover to cover edits. And of course I would have people read it and then give me, you know, write in the margins and whatnot. And so I got help with what I should edit or what didn't flow, but I kept editing it 7 full edits so that I took it from collegiate down to 12th grade, down to 11th grade. I think then I made like a jump to like 9th grade, then 7th grade. And then I think 6th grade is where this book landed on readability. Now, you know, I will say it's not, a 6th grader is not going to enjoy the read because it's about business, marketing, persuasion, influence, 4 things you should look at in finance, you know, how to hire, how to fire, how to build teams. That's not fun for a 6th grader, but the readability factor is whoever reads it and puts it down will take the lessons with them versus, you know, okay, I just read a chapter. Now I got to decipher what I read and what did he really mean by this? That's actually it's a hard book to read, like when it's written that way. And so I really am proud, and it's funny, somebody actually reached out to me and said, I loved your book. You know, I don't want to shake this the wrong way, but it was really an easy read. I'm like, dude, I worked my ass off to make this an easy read. Like, that's a compliment. You know, that's a compliment. I didn't want it to be a complicated read. I want it to be an effective read. I don't want to be a best writing author. I'd rather be a best-selling author that gives value in that. And so I say all that, and yes, that was a shameless plug for the book, available on Amazon, and all proceeds go to a charity that helps with mental health and suicide prevention. But I say that because it comes right back to your listeners. Speak to people, not down to them, but in a way that is relatable and understandable and simple, and you will be amazed at how they will just let their guard down, let their resistance down, because they don't feel like you're trying to sell them and you're trying to help them. And I would bet my bottom dollar, your book of business will grow. And if you're starting a company, that will grow and flourish because people will find ways to help you grow because you've helped them. You've genuinely helped them. And man, the world needs more of that because everybody's hawking something today.
I love that. I love that answer. And there is no shameless plug. I think that the book, and I think that what you kind of ran over was where the proceeds of the book go for mental health and suicide prevention. I mean, that's a phenomenal cause. And so I don't want that to be, you know, voiced over. I'm a big proponent of mental health and everybody should be looking into their own and helping others as well. It shouldn't be taboo. It should be talked about. And, yeah. You know, An Insider's Guide to Business is the book and the proceeds go to a great, great, great cause. You know, I want to take time to wrap up here because, you know, sure. There's so much more that we didn't get to, you know, the last part of growth, and we will get to that maybe in a follow-on podcast with you. I've really enjoyed it. I appreciate your vulnerability and your insights. Before I let you go though, there's 2 questions I need to ask because I ask all my guests. And the first one is I love to learn from people smarter than myself, like yourself. And I like to learn through reading. And so, you know, outside of your own book, what's another book that you think everybody should read or reread if they haven't already?
I usually answer this the exact same way every time. And it's one, you should always be reading. Always have a book going. So that full stop, always have a book going, if not 2 or 3. But we, and me included, have really just repositioned certain thoughts, certain things. Go back and reread How to Win Friends and Influence People. Dale Carnegie, written in the 30s. Like, it is mine. I have several copies of it, but the paperback's my favorite one for whatever reason. And you know, the cover's gone. It's yellow. It's just, you know, it's like, I've read that book so many times because every time in your life, the book hasn't changed. Like, it's so funny. People are like, oh, you know, I really got more out of it this time. Yeah. Because you've changed. You're, you know, a man doesn't walk in this, you know, the same river, doesn't step in the same river twice because the river's never the same and the man's never the same. Same thing with a book. You never experience a book the same way as you age and you gain wisdom and you gain life experience and, you know, get some scar tissue. And so you'll get something new from it. And then secondarily, all I read is nonfiction, usually business, self-help, biography. I love business biographies. But I think the best book ever written, ever, is Atlas Shrugged, and by Ayn Rand. And if your listeners have not read that book, and if your listeners' teenage children haven't read that book, it's a must. It'll never be mandatory reading in our public school system, unfortunately. It should be. It is just a love letter to capitalism and how efficient capitalism is and how beautiful capitalism is. And yes, it can have, like any system, its negative aspects. But Ayn Rand was a Russian immigrant in the 50s who literally foretold the future. You read this book and then you realize, oh my gosh, this book was written 75 years ago and it's happening in front of us today. So how to win friends and influence people. You'll make more money. You'll be happier. Your clients will be happier because you'll be genuinely working with them on their side of the table. And read Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. If you haven't, it'll scare the hell out of you, but also make you really appreciate just how beautiful capitalism is when it's left alone.
Yeah, love that. Love that. Last piece of advice. What's a lightning round actionable takeaway that you hope people can take away from this conversation that we had? We talked about a ton, or maybe it's something we didn't talk about, but what's something actionable that you think that is digestible that people can implement today, tomorrow, whatever it may be, and be better themselves or their business or their clients, whatever it may be?
Yep. This is going to sound trite and a cliche and, oh my gosh, he's just quoting everybody on Instagram and, you know, so, but it's true. Don't quit. Don't ever, 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 ever give up. And so whether you're building your book, you're just starting, you're building your book, whether you're super established, but you want to go to the next level, and if you don't, you either grow or die. So you have to go to the next level. Or as we've talked about, you're going off on your own. There will probably not be a week. There hasn't been for me. I've been doing this on my own for, you know, almost 8 years now. Probably not a week that there's not one day I wake up and I lay in bed and I stare at the ceiling and go, I don't know if I can do this today. This is really, 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 really hard. And by all means, I'm successful at this. And it's really freaking hard. And so you have to know it's going to be hard. And you have to know that, oh yeah, that dude on that podcast did say that. Oh yeah, that guy on Instagram said, oh, you know what? My boss, my mentor, my father, they did say this was going to be hard. Like the reason we say it's hard, but don't quit is because we're living it. We've been there. And I say this and you give me, you know, what's the one thing you want to say? I think it's the most important to say this because it's so easy to quit, especially in today's world. It's nobody's fault and everybody's a victim and yada, yada, yada. Although I think we said we weren't going to talk about politics, but there was my little rant. But my son, again, who's 20, the last time I took him to the airport, he had flown home for Thanksgiving or something, driving to the airport. So, you know, Dad, what advice do you have for me? I'm going back out to LA, you know, and this young kid out in LA. And I said, don't quit. Just keep going. Keep making, he's just dropped his first album. Just keep releasing music. Keep releasing songs. Keep making content. Do not stop because, son, you are going to get to the point and it won't be tomorrow. It won't be next year. It won't be 3 years, but you'll wake up one day and everyone who started this journey with you will have quit and you'll be the last man standing. And by default, you'll be successful. But between now and then, there's going to be a huge suck factor. But if you know that, you'll know. I expect this. And so to your listeners who are about to try it, who are in the thick of it, or they're worn out because they've been doing it. And usually it's when you're worn out, just don't quit. Just don't quit.
I love that. That's so true. That's so true. It may be said a lot, but you got to hear it again and again because you don't know when it's going to resonate the most or when you're going to be in the moment where it hits you the most. And so you can't say it enough. Well, you know, Roger, I've really enjoyed this conversation. Really appreciate your insight. All of the information you provided, you know, I'm a fan. I can't wait to continue to follow your journey and continue to learn from you. And I know there's many more out there that we're going to want to do the same. So what's the best way for people to continue to follow your journey, get in touch with you and stay in touch?
Oh, I appreciate that. And one, you're an amazing host and interviewer, by the way, just great questions, really insightful. Really, I've really enjoyed this. I've gotten just as much out of it. They can follow me at, they can connect with me on LinkedIn or Instagram or any of the socials at Real Roger Martin, R-O-G-E-R. And they can go to thrivemorebrands.com, thrivemore brands, just the three words all together.com. And that's going to show the different brands we have, different media. I think the book's on there, a bunch of stuff. But that's if you're interested in franchising, if you're interested in learning more about it, if you have a business, you're interested in possibly franchising that, or you just want to connect with me through that, that's probably the easiest way to find me.
Love it. Roger, thanks so much. Can't wait to have you back on. Can't wait to continue our conversation. And thank you again, man, for everything on this podcast. And so stay well, be well, and we'll talk with you soon.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Bridging the Gap. Don't forget to give us a rating and let us know what you think.